it's difficult to see all these people here with their Bibles, knowing that we're going to spend the next hour in describing God's dealing in history, but in what we call the intertestament period, which means that the majority of the references that I'll be making go to Josephus's books, who's a Jewish historian covering that time period, and the Maccabees, which, unless you're fresh out of Catholic Church, you probably don't have those books in your Bibles, 1st and 2nd Maccabees. So I will, however, refer you to the book of Daniel, even though Daniel was written, Daniel was detailed in about the 530s BC. And as you read this, about this history that we're covering in the 300s to 100s BC, it is actually like reading Kings or Chronicles or any of these other historical books, even though they were written more than 200 years before. These prophecies in Daniel were written more than 200 years before the events unfolded. They do read like history. So I think that's pretty much the only Bible references we'll be making tonight, believe it or not, is in teaching history class, is reading these historical things that we're told in advance. So the majority of our references tonight will be Josephus, the Maccabees, and Daniel. When we left off in our study of history last week, we talked about Alexander the Great. Now, for understanding the Bible timeline, I guess I should have covered this last week, last of the Old Testament writers, who was Malachi, the prophet Malachi. Fortunately, he's the last guy in the Old Testament as well. It works out that way, although usually those things don't work out chronologically. For example, in the New Testament, the book of Revelation, which is the last book in the New Testament, was actually written before the Gospel of John, which is one of the first books in the New Testament. So go figure how that stuff works. But anyway, the last guy, Malachi, passed off the scene about 100 years before Alexander the Great. So we're definitely in the intertestament period. It's the period of time between the Old Testament ending and the New Testament beginning. So we're in that period of time. Alexander the Great rose to power. The Greek Empire became a world empire. He conquered all the known world. Died at a very young age, unexpectedly. He was just a month or so shy of his 33rd birthday when he died. And, of course, didn't have plans in place for, you know, passing the torch to somebody else. And so the generals who had been in charge of his armies divided up the kingdom, and it became a real brutal, bloody battle for a number of decades as they all fought for position, and they all wanted to be Alexander the Great. They all wanted to you know, occupy all the world, and so it was really brutal. Ended up resulting in basically four kingdoms, four kings and four kingdoms, two of which we kind of zeroed in on near the end of the study, and that was the kingdom down in Egypt that was run by Ptolemy and began the Ptolemaic dynasty. And that's Ptolemy with a P, by the way, P-T-O-L-E-M-Y. So if you've ever seen the word but never heard it pronounced, Ptolemy was down in Egypt. And Seleucid, who was in basically occupied the Middle East, mostly Syria and Mesopotamia. When they were going at it back and forth, you can imagine if there's a back and forth between Syria and Egypt, poor Israel's in the middle. And that's why we focused mostly on those two dynasties, the Ptolemaic dynasty in the south in Egypt, and the Seleucid dynasty up in the north, and I'm talking about in relation to Israel. So the south and north of Israel, Israel ended up being basically the rope in a tug of war. And it was, if you can imagine that being the rope in a tug of war would be kind of stressful, literally. And so that's kind of the situation they were in. Now, the Seleucid dynasty started in 312 BC. So that's where we are now, 312 BC. And continues on for several generations. There's a lot of back and forth with not only between those two dynasties, between the ones, the guys in the south in Egypt and the guys in the north in Syria, but there's generations that pass, and so Seleucid is replaced, you know, and you get the first and the second and the third, and Ptolemy, same thing, you get the first and the second and third, and other kings' names thrown in between there. So generations go by, and really what's interesting, we're not going to cover that history, although if you become a student of Daniel chapter 11, you'll learn that history. Because as you look at it, Daniel gets very specific, or the prophecy that's given to Daniel is very specific and is just fascinatingly accurate. When you learn that history, you can get it from secular sources, but then go back and read Daniel and say, wow, this is exactly what I've been reading, although it was 200 or 300 years before these things happened. Now, by the 200s B.C., Antiochus. Now I've used both pronunciations, Antiochus and Antiochus, and Antiochus rolls off my tongue better. Antiochus is actually probably better Greek, but I'll probably do it interchangeably because I'm so used to the other. But Antiochus III is now the king of Syria, up in the north of the Seleucid dynasty. And during his reign, he goes to war against Rome, 192 B.C., Antiochus III goes to war against Rome. Now, Rome, you think, what's Rome? Rome's nothing. I mean, the Roman Empire isn't going to be anything until, well, historians say it's usually about 67, I think it is. Wonder if I jotted that down. 27 BC. I actually did jot that down. About 200 years later, in 27 BC, is the year that historians will give you as the beginning, the date of the beginning of the Roman Empire. You know, you've heard of the rise and the fall of the Roman Empire. 27 BC tends to be the date when they're credited as, you know, hey, it's the Roman Empire. But Rome is no slouch even now, 200 years before. And so the Seleucid dynasty, led by Antiochus III, goes to war against Rome, and Rome is nothing to be tangled with even back then, and he loses. When that happens, as most wars resulted in, is it didn't do you any good to kill off everybody in the whole nation. So what you did is you won the war, and then you exacted tribute, which is basically really heavy taxation annually given to us, the winners. We want that money, and if you don't pay us the money, we're going to come back and beat you some more, kind of thing. So Rome, every year, is getting all this money from the Seleucids. Antiochus, having lost, obviously, being the one paying it. And when Antiochus III dies, his son Seleucus IV, so you can see it's a Seleucid dynasty, but we had an Antiochus in there. Now we've got Seleucus IV, his son. He inherits this Roman debt every year. He's the king, and he's having to exact super heavy taxes on his own people in order to pay tribute to Rome so they don't come and wipe them out. So he's leveling these super heavy taxes on his people, and he gets word about the temple in Jerusalem. Apparently, they got some cash laying around. Apparently, they've been saving up some money. And Second Maccabees, and again, I'll be referring to First and Second Maccabees. These are apocryphal books, meaning they've not been included in the 66 books of the Bible. First and Second Maccabees tends to be fairly accurate history, although they were not included in the scriptural canon. We call it the canon. They weren't included in the Bible for a number of good reasons, as are pretty much any book that you would come up to me and ask me, well, why isn't the Book of Enoch, you know, why isn't that in the Bible, or why isn't the Epistle of Barnabas in the Bible? Believe me, there's good reasons, and we could go into all the apocryphal books, and that would take us a year. Maybe that'll be our next year study. We'll study all the apocryphal books of the Bible and why they're not inspired and why we just wasted a whole year. But there is some pretty good history in First and Second Maccabees. After that, the Maccabean books are like, woo, out there. And anyway, if you pick them up as history, you know, you're not sinning or anything, but just remember they're not scripture. Second Maccabees chapter 3, verse 6 says that the king heard that Jerusalem's temple treasury was full of untold sums of money. so that the amount of the funds could not be reckoned, and that they did not belong to the account of the sacrifices, but that it was possible for them to fall under the control of the king. So at this time in history, the land of Israel is under Seleucid control. And the king hears, hey, wait a second, there's money in the temple there in Jerusalem. Why haven't they paid us this money, or why aren't they paying taxes on this money? So he decides to send his kingdom's treasurer, Heliodorus is the guy's name, went on to invent things like the helicopter and other things. Not really. Heliodorus, the treasurer of the Seleucid Empire, the Seleucid dynasty, is sent to Jerusalem to take an accounting and check all this stuff out and bring a report back to the king. Well, apparently he was making plans on this trip and must have gotten enough money in place to hire some guys, because when Heliodorus came back, he had Seleucus IV killed, and Heliodorus jumps on the throne. So he's like, oh, now I'm the king. Well, that didn't last very long at all. The younger brother of Seleucus IV was a guy named Antiochus, also Antiochus IV, but we know him better as Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, he wasn't going to stand for, hey, this guy had my brother killed and jumps on the throne. That's not going to happen. So he has this guy promptly removed and puts the rightful heir onto the throne, who is Seleucus IV's son, who's Antiochus Epiphanes, or Antiochus IV's nephew. It's a baby. I mean, it's a baby. Here, he put the baby on the throne. I can't even sit up. Put the baby on the throne. And obviously, he says, well, I've got to appoint myself as the guardian of this baby. So basically, he's acting as the king, because there's this baby on the throne, and the rightful heir, but he's a baby. So he has himself appointed as the guardian, but then mysteriously, within about 5 years, the baby boy is murdered. And so Antiochus IV hops on the throne and says, hey, well, I'm the next guy, kind of thing. So interestingly enough, this act had been prophesied to Daniel 360 years before the fact. Daniel chapter 11, verse 21, speaking of Seleucus IV, the guy that was assassinated, in his place, a despicable person will arise. Now, what you're going to find out is, of all the bad things that are said about all the bad people in the Bible, Antiochus and the Antichrist tend to be the top two bad people. This guy, Antiochus Epiphanes, or Antiochus IV, and the Antichrist are frequently referred to as despicable, ungodly, big mouth, boasting, just horrible, horrible things that God is sickened by the very people that they are. And so in his place, in Seleucus IV's place, in his place, a despicable person will arise on whom the honor of kingship has not been conferred, but he will come in a time of tranquility and seize the kingdom by intrigue. So this description here, 360 years before, details this exactly, that he is a despicable person. He didn't have the honor of kingship conferred upon him, but he gained the throne by intrigue. So having taken the kingdom by intrigue, Antiochus decides to solidify the Seleucid kingdom, and he does this in a couple of ways. Militarily, by expanding and solidifying his borders through wars and battles and things, but also socially or culturally, you could say. One of the desires of Antiochus IV was to Hellenize his whole kingdom. Now, to Hellenize, that's a very strange term, and maybe you've heard of the Hellenistic Jews as you're reading through the book of Acts early on. Basically, the Greek word for Greek is Hellen. So if we would say the English word for English is English, okay? The Spanish word for Spanish is Espanol, okay? The Greek word for Greek is Hellen. Don't ask me where it came from. I don't know. It's Greek. It's all Greek to you and me. So the Greek word for Greek is Hellen. Therefore, to Hellenize someone or a group of people means to make them Greek, essentially to have them adopt the culture and the language and the thought and the styles of classical Greek culture. That's what it is to Hellenize them. So when you hear later on in the book of Acts about the Hellenized Jews, these are guys, you know, they're in togas and they're speaking Greek. And, you know, it's like it seemed very, very odd to the Jews in the apostles' day to see the Hellenized Jews. Culturally, they were light years apart, but they were Jews, you know. And that was the conflict, by the way. I think it was in Acts chapter 6. It might have been, I think it was Acts chapter 6, that this conflict arose between the Jews and the Hellenized Jews. Between the Hellenized Jews were saying, hey, our widows aren't being given food, you know, at the church, you know, soup kitchen line kind of thing. So that's what it means. Hellenized means to adopt the Greek language, the Greek culture, the Greek styles, that kind of thing. A lot of the Seleucid Empire adopted Greek culture, you know, Hellenized very easily. You can imagine that the Jews were somewhat, you know, hesitant, or at least some of them were. The high priest of the day, there was actually a couple, and they kind of went back and forth, but at this point, it was a guy named Jason that was the high priest of the day. He'd bidded for the high priesthood, and he would be outbid by somebody else very soon. But the high priesthood was so very corrupt during this time that it was pretty easy for him to tell the people, hey, you know, this is good. You know, let's start wearing togas. And I'm exaggerating about this, but you know, let's kind of be Greek about the whole thing. And many of the Jews in Israel, and especially in Jerusalem, did allow themselves to be Hellenized, so much so that they built a Colosseum in Jerusalem. You know, a Colosseum like where they had wrestling and discus throwing and these kind of sports. They really did. So as you're thinking about these early Olympic style, when you think of Greeks and the Olympics and all that kind of stuff, that's what Jerusalem was starting to look like. And that's what the Jews, not all the Jews, but a lot of the Jews in Jerusalem were starting to behave like and appear like and sound like. And as a result, the temple sacrifices and the rituals began to be neglected. And there's a struggle during these years for the high priesthood, and it ends up being this military kind of thing. War breaks out between the factions. This is in 169 BC, that actual war between these two, you know, candidates for high priest and all their followers actually are at war. And Antiochus IV, he hears about this. He hears, man, there's war in Jerusalem. You know, there's war in Judea. There's fighting. Well, he thinks that Judea is in revolt. 2 Maccabees 5 says, when news of what had happened reached the king, he took it to mean that Judea was in revolt. So raging inwardly, and what we find out is this guy's a hothead, and he gets more and more angry as the years go by, and more just psychoses tend to just come out of him, and anger and hatred and things. He was in Egypt at the time, conquering Egypt, you know, and he leaves Egypt, takes the city by storm. He commanded his soldiers to cut down relentlessly everyone they met and to kill those who went into their houses. Then there was massacre of young and old, destruction of boys, women, and children, and slaughter of young girls and infants. Within the total of 3 days, 80,000 were destroyed, 40,000 in hand-to-hand fighting, and as many were sold into slavery as were killed. So 80,000 people destroyed, another 80,000 of them being sold into slavery. And this was because the king heard there was fighting over the high priesthood. Horrible, horrible, you know, 160,000 people either killed or sold into slavery. And it didn't matter who you were. If you were there, they got you. And this was the kind of king that he was. Now, Antiochus's desire to Hellenize the Jews went from, hey, you know, this is what we're doing in the kingdom, to this is a command, and if you don't do it, you're going to die. And he set about to completely just destroy Judaism. I would say inexplainable hatred of Jews that Antiochus had, but it's not inexplainable. It was demonic. It was certainly of the devil, as anti-Semitism is today. And he set about to destroy Judaism. He decreed that the Jewish worship was unlawful. It was against the law to worship the way the Jews worshiped. No one was allowed to observe the Sabbath anymore. You weren't allowed to observe the feast. Circumcision was forbidden. If it was found that you circumcised your baby boy, then the boy and you would be put to death. All copies of the Torah, of the scriptures, the Old Testament scriptures, were to be turned in, to be destroyed. And the Jews would be forced to sacrifice to idols that were constructed then, that the Seleucids came in and brought in idols and altars and said, this is how you guys are going to worship, this is what you guys are going to worship, and this is where you're going to sacrifice. And then he placed officers throughout the land of Israel, all throughout, that were like enforcers. You know, they were the, I don't know what you'd call them. What was that? Like the secret police kind of thing. And they would go through and your house would be inspected every month to see if you had any of the sacred writings there or if your children were circumcised. And it was a brutal, horrible kind of thing. Any law that you were found to have broken in practicing Judaism, any form of Judaism that you were practicing, no matter how small, they would put you to death immediately. So this is what the Jews in Israel were living under at the command of Antiochus. And Josephus writes in his book, maybe you have Josephus' works at home. If you do, you can jot down Wars of the Jews. He wrote a number of books. Usually they're all compiled together. Wars of the Jews, the very beginning of the book, you know, book one, chapter one, paragraph one, actually paragraph two. So Wars 1:1-2. He writes, "Now Antiochus was not satisfied either with his unexpected taking of the city or with its pillage or with the great slaughter he had made there. But being overcome with his violent passions and remembering what he had suffered during the siege, he compelled the Jews to dissolve the laws of their country, to keep their infants uncircumcised, and to sacrifice swine's flesh upon the altars, against which they all opposed themselves, and the most approved among them were put to death." So anybody that tried to stick up for themselves and for righteousness, shouldn't say for themselves, stick up for righteousness and God's law, they put them to death. And then before Antiochus left Jerusalem, after this slaughter and after this institution of these laws, before he left, he made sure to have everything valuable taken from the temple, just stripped the temple bare of anything. 1 Maccabees chapter 1 says, "After subduing Egypt, Antiochus returned in the 143rd year. He went up against Israel, came to Jerusalem with a strong force. He arrogantly entered the sanctuary." So he went into the temple, "took the golden altar, the lampstand, all its utensils, the bread table for the bread of the presence, the cups, the bowls, the golden censers, the curtain, the crowns, the gold decoration on the front of the temple. He stripped it all off. He took the silver and the gold and the costly vessels. He took also the hidden treasures that he found. Taking them all, he went into his own land. He shed much blood and spoke with great arrogance." So there's another, you know, talking about his big mouth, speaking with great arrogance. Antiochus was certainly arrogant. This is about the time that he takes the name Epiphanes. Antiochus Epiphanes. Epiphanes means God manifest, meaning I'm God incarnate. I'm God visible. I'm God on earth. I'm Antiochus Epiphanes. And so what was interesting, though, is he insisted on being called this, but not everybody called him this, especially not behind his back. And you find historical writings that they didn't call him Epiphanes all the time. They called him Epimenes. Epimenes means the madman. And so like, oh, he's not Epiphanes, he's Epimenes. You know, he's not God manifest, he's a loony boon, you know, or loony tune, whatever you call that. And surely he was. He was like, you just can't believe this as you study this guy and you study this guy's life and you see him going from being mean to being evil to being, I mean, creating ways of doing evil, just horrible, horrible kind of stuff. He thought himself to be God. And so before Antiochus left, he not only entered the temple, he went into the Holy of Holies And you can imagine, I mean, you should be afraid that God would strike you dead. Of course, the temple had long since been neglected and defiled. The glory of God was not dwelling there. But man, just the, you know, and a foreshadowing of the Antichrist. For the Antichrist will do the same thing. He will enter into the Holy of Holies and also oppose and exalt himself above all that is called God or worshipped. So it's a foreshadowing of the Antichrist in our future still, who will do this very same thing in the same place up on Temple Mount. You'd think it couldn't get any worse than that, but the worst was actually yet to come. The Jews, of course, were not Antiochus' only concern. You realize that he had a whole kingdom to deal with, and these Jews, although really annoying, he was pretty well done. I mean, he passed a bunch of laws that made it tough for him. He stole all their stuff, and now let's go on somewhere else. So, especially the military conquests in Egypt commanded his attention. He needed to focus in on that. But the next year, the Romans, who are getting more and more powerful, the Roman Senate sent him a message saying, by the way, you're going to evacuate from Egypt. Oh, yeah, why? Well, we're going to destroy you if you don't leave Egypt. So, what do you do? He knows Rome can beat him. They beat his predecessor, certainly, or his predecessor's father, and he can't stand up to Rome. And so Rome said, get out of Egypt. And he was so angry, but he realized, I better get out of Egypt. So he rallies his guys together, and it takes almost a year to do this pullout. But 167 BC, he's got his military, he's leading his military out of Egypt. They're leaving the south, they're going back home to the north. What's in the way? Israel's in the way. Jerusalem's in the way. And he's mad. I mean, he's really mad. He's like seething angry. Now, about this time, he hears about some rebels. We'll talk about these rebels in a little bit. But he hears about some rebels that are opposing, not just opposing the law, but opposing it physically, like taking out some of his soldiers and things. And it makes him madder. So he's dealing with the humiliation of Rome saying, get out of Egypt. He's dealing with the humiliation of actually having to pull out of Egypt. He's dealing with the anger towards there's some rebels in Israel killing my people or killing my military guys. And so he heads straight for Jerusalem. And he is as mad as anybody you could ever imagine. And he's insane. And he's all powerful because he has a huge army at his disposal. So, he was certainly out for blood. Daniel's prophecy said of him, this is Daniel chapter 8, verse 24. Daniel 8, 24 says, his power will be mighty, but not by his own power. That's a really strange thing. It says that his power will be mighty, but not by his own power, and he will destroy to an extraordinary degree and prosper and perform his will. He will destroy mighty men and the holy people. God knew in advance what this guy would do. He also knew how he would do it. His power would be mighty, but not by his own power. What does that mean? He's the king. What do you mean, not by his own power? I believe this is a scriptural clue to show us that the historical figure, Antiochus Epiphanes, was demon-possessed. I firmly believe that. I'll go to my grave believing that. God can correct me later if I'm wrong. But not only, and I'm kind of extreme in my views, because if you talk to most secular historians, you say, oh yeah, Antiochus Epiphanes, I think he was demon-possessed. They're like, demon-possessed? What are you talking about? Well, whatever. But I think he was more than demon-possessed. I think that he was one of the three guys that we see in Scripture that was actually possessed by the devil himself. Everything that you read about Antiochus, everything that you see him doing, at very least demon-possessed. His power was not his own power, but I believe it was Satan himself. In the same way that Satan entered into Judas, in the same way that Satan will enter into the Antichrist, I believe that Antiochus Epiphanes, the foreshadowing of the Antichrist, certainly I believe he was possessed by the devil himself. Now, he's on his way to Jerusalem. He hears about these rebels, sent into a seething rage. He orders that upon entering into Jerusalem, and this is going to be brutal. I mean, this is going to be another bloodbath. But he orders that upon entering into Jerusalem, he has the guys find the biggest pig in the whole land. And once they have, once his guys have solidified the place, made it safe militarily, basically, he, having ordered this pig and having his military strike down as many people as it takes to make the city safe, he hops on the pig and rides it into the temple. Now, if you don't realize what this is communicating to a Jew, maybe you're not familiar with the term kosher. Pigs are not kosher. They're an unclean animal. It's like the epitome of the unclean animal. You know, a Jew who lives by the law of Moses will not eat ham or pork chops or bacon or, I mean, it's a bummer. You know, it's like the law is difficult. The law is impossible to follow. Just because no bacon? What do you mean no bacon? Well, no bacon. The animal is unclean. The pig is unclean, which I think is really funny because when you think of Jewish food, you can't think of Jewish food without thinking of the bagel. Well, what do all the breakfast places sell? Man, you get a bagel with your choice of ham, bacon, or sausage. It's like, always struck me as odd. He rides this giant pig into the temple courts, sacrifices it on the altar of sacrifice, on this holy, God-sanctified altar. In the temple courts, he sacrifices this pig. He forces the priests that are still alive to drink the pig's blood, smears the pig's blood all over the walls of the inside of the holy place, and then erects this altar to Zeus, depending on which part of history. They're all the same god. Zeus, Jupiter, Olympus, all the same god. So depending on what historian you're reading, they'll either refer to Zeus, Olympus, or Jupiter. Sets up this altar to Zeus in the Holy of Holies. It's like defiling the place. Just unbelievable. Just horrible. The pig's fat was used to burn the copies of the Torah that had been confiscated. 1 Maccabees chapter 1 says, now on the 15th day of Kislev, that's the month, it's around November, December, our time. In the 145th year, they erected a desolating sacrilege on the altar of burnt offering. They also built altars in the surrounding towns of Judah, offering incense at the doors of the houses and in the street. The books of the law that they found, they tore to pieces and burned with fire. Anyone found possessing the book of the covenant or anyone adhered to the law was condemned to death by decree of the king. They kept using violence against Israel, against those who were found month after month in the towns. On the 25th day of the month, they offered sacrifice on the altar that was on top of the altar of burnt offering. According to the decree, they put to death the women who had their children circumcised and their families and those who circumcised them. And they hung the infants from the mother's necks. But many in Israel stood firm and were resolved in their hearts not to eat the unclean food. They chose rather to die than to be defiled by food or to profane the holy covenant. And they did die. Very great wrath came upon Israel. Antiochus initiates every kind of torture that was known to man at the time to force the Jews to renounce Judaism. He despised it to such a degree. It wasn't like he was a king saying, hey, come on, can't we all just get along? You know, I want everybody to be the same. I want you all in the same style, the same language, same culture. This is a personal vendetta against Judaism. Think Adolf Hitler, if you would. Looking at Judaism as something so personally hated that he wanted to see it wiped from the face of the earth. He was going to do everything he could to get the Jews to renounce their religion or die. Now, the Jews, this is a time in the Jews' history when they were really pushed to the brink of destruction. There's been a number of times in history that we've studied and that you'll see even in recent years of the Jews almost being wiped from the face of the earth. And this is how we need to look, obviously, at history is God's faithfulness to his people against all odds, obviously. But how he does this is unique each time. Each time it's fascinating to me. Now, earlier on, when Antiochus was on his way to Jerusalem and he heard about this rebellion that was taking place, this is what was going on. Some Seleucid soldiers, this was after the first invasion and destruction and pillaging of the people of Jerusalem, when all these laws were instituted and the soldiers are sent out to all over the land of Judea to make, you know, sure that Judaism wasn't being practiced and that the pagan sacrifices were being made. Seleucid soldiers arrived at the village of Modein, and their job, as was all the soldiers who went out into all these Israeli towns, their job was to force the residents to offer sacrifices to this pagan image, this pagan altar that had been set up. And these soldiers run into some trouble. The leader of Modein is a guy named Mattathias. He's a Jew. He's a leader of the village there. And Mattathias refuses to sacrifice. Now, this is a bad example. The Seleucid guys are thinking, this is a really bad example. Because if the leader won't do it, nobody else would. And they threatened him and everything. He's like, I ain't going to do it. Well, this one other Jew in the town says, man, you're going to get us all in trouble, and goes running up. He says, well, I'll offer the sacrifice then. And he goes to offer this sacrifice on this pagan altar. Well, Mattathias grabs the sword of one of the Seleucid soldiers and goes and kills the guy. And then him and his sons, I think there was five of them, like fall upon the Seleucid soldiers and kill them all. This was a really bad day to be a Syrian, you know. And then they rally this rebellion together. It's pretty small, but they say, you know, we're going to be Jews and die being Jews rather than, you know, compromise and give up on our God. And so Mattathias, when he's there, basically they get some guys together and they're hiding in the mountain, you know, hiding out in the wilderness places and doing this guerrilla warfare, terrorism kind of thing. Mattathias is killed pretty soon after. And so his son Judas takes command of this rebel army. Now, I know Judas seems to be a bad name. Actually, it's a pretty good name. If you look at everybody except Judas Iscariot, Judas is a pretty good name. I mean, Jesus' brother was named Judas. We call him Jude because Judas is such a negative name. Judas, this guy, Judas, he takes over command of this rebel army, and his fighting style, these people that wrote of his fighting style in history, one of the quotes is that he's described as like a lion in his rage. I mean, this guy is a phenomenal, he's like Rambo or something, you know, he's like Conan or whatever, however you want to picture that. And he is, he's crazy on the battlefield. And they give him a nickname, the Hammerer. Now, I don't want to think about where he gets this nickname from, you know. Maybe instead of Conan, he's like Thor, you know. He's like, you know, squishing people. The Hammerer is Maccabeus. That's what the Hammer is. So he's called Judas Maccabeus. Judas the Hammerer. Now, Judas Maccabeus leads all kinds of battles against Antiochus's armies. And in one battle that was really, really definitive, they got their army, the Jews' rebel army, up to 6,000 men. You think, man, that's a lot. Well, unfortunately, the army of the Syrians that they were facing were 40,000 men. So you've got 60,000 against 40,000. And their defeat was so certain that the Syrian general actually called in 1,000 slave traders. Now, slave traders, they're merchants, they're business guys, you know, and they buy slaves captured on the battlefield, and then, you know, they give the conquering army money, and they take the slaves and they go sell them at the market. Well, this Syrian general is so convinced that this is going to be a bloodbath. It's 40,000 against 6,000. He gets 1,000 slave traders and said, bring lots of money and bring lots of chains. Well, the Jews won, and many of those slave traders didn't survive because they were dumb enough to come along. And the victory was so, not only was it so definitive, but it was so inspiring that many more Jews joined this Maccabean rebellion, this Maccabean revolt. And they basically ended up with 4,000 more volunteers. So now the Jews are up to about 10,000 in their rebel army here. The next battle against another prominent Syrian general, they won as well. And that gave them the ability to re-enter and to repossess the city of Jerusalem. So that was very key. Excuse me. It had been 3 years, 3 years of living and hiding, guerrilla warfare, you know, hand-to-hand combat, 3 years, but they had managed to recapture Jerusalem for the Jews. And about this time, Antiochus, he's leading another one of his armies, and he's off in the east in Persia, you know, basically Iran area. Things aren't going very well for him. He goes into this one city, Persepolis, I think is how it's pronounced. And the inhabitants of this Iranian or this Persian city, like, weren't going to take the invasion by Antiochus laying down. So pretty much everybody in the city got weapons and ran after the army. And the Seleucid army, the Syrians, like, ran away. And so they were basically run out of Persia, and not a real good thing, because remember how Antiochus deals with his anger? He takes it out on the Jews. He takes it out on the Jews. Now, he's just been run out of Persia. He's headed west from Iran. You head west from Iran, where are you going to end up? Oh, no. Well, the army's back on their way. They're gonna get Jerusalem and just decimate the Jews to take out this this loss on them. But interestingly enough, on his way to Jerusalem, 2 Maccabees 9 says, he was seized with a pain in his bowels, for which there was no relief. How do you spell relief? N-O, you know, there's no relief here. And with sharp internal tortures. So he gets Montezuma's revenge or something. I don't know what it is that he gets, but his afflictions increase. He doesn't just have pain in his bowels and sharp intestinal tortures. He ends up, and he's hurting so bad, and they're riding furiously. I mean, he had actually told his guys to ride furiously to Jerusalem. He was so mad. He was going to end the Jews, and that was going to be it. And he's hurting so bad, and he falls out of his chariot, ends up breaking a bunch of bones. You know, it says that, I forget the literal, I didn't jot this into my notes, but it basically says every one of his members, you know, is injured as he's like tumbling off his chariot. And then, and he's still refusing. It kind of reminds me of Pharaoh in Egypt when Moses is saying, look, are you sick of these plagues yet? Let my people go. No, I won't let your people go. And then it gets worse, you know. How about now? No, and it gets worse and worse. So he goes from, you know, having Montezuma's revenge, kind of intestinal pain, to he falls off his chariot and breaks his legs and his arms and things. And then he ends up, and he's still on his way to Jerusalem, he ends up being afflicted with this horrible flesh-eating disease. And here, 2 Maccabees 9 says, the ungodly man's body, there's another great description of him, the ungodly man. The ungodly man's body swarmed with worms. And, isn't this great? And come on, it's Antiochus Epiphanes. You're not rooting for the guy, are you? His body swarmed with worms, and while he was still living in anguish and pain, his flesh rotted away. And because of the stench, the whole army felt revulsion at his decay. You know, the king's out in the front of this charging, you know, line, and they're all like downwind, you know, they're like, oh, man. And it got to the point where he can't ride in his chariot anymore, so somebody's going to have to carry him. And it says, because of his intolerable stench, no one was able to carry the man. So it's interesting to me that Daniel chapter 8, verse 25, did prophesy of this guy that he will be broken without human agency. This despicable guy would be broken without human agency. This was God saying, hey, I didn't have him killed in a war, or I'm not going to have him killed in a war. I'm not going to have him die of old age. I'm not going to have him, you know, I'm going to deal with it. I'm going to deal with it. You mess with my people, and I'll mess with you. That's God's plan through the whole Bible. You know, it's like, how many times do we have to cover this before we get it? You mess with God's people, God messes with you. Antiochus Epiphanes, he dies of this. Hooray. And, you know, not in war, not being assassinated, not like you'd expect the Seleucid king to die. It was not by human agency. Now, that same year, that was 164 BC. And this same year, in December, the Jews, having regained Jerusalem, Antiochus Epiphanes dead. Now, they're not out of the water yet. They have many more years of fighting the Syrians. But they cleanse the temple. They, you know, wash the pig's blood off and redo stuff. And basically, they... it had been defiled. It had been made desolate. This was what Daniel the prophet had called the abomination that causes desolation. The temple had been made desolate. Well, they cleanse it. Wasn't that Andy Taylor's deputy? The 25th? You know, there's a Mexican restaurant in town, and I don't want to say which one it is, but they have mariachis every other Wednesday. And it's great because you go in at any other time and they'll tell you when the next date is. And very often it'll say like next mariachi night, April 23rd. I don't know. 2-3-T-H, 23rd. So I guess the 25th isn't as bad. It's the 25th of... I said it again. Okay. I didn't get a nap today, all right? It's all this tryptophan from the turkey. It's just going through and making me dumb. It's Kislev 25. It's the 25th. There you go. 25th of Kislev that they rededicate the temple. It's been cleansed. It gets rededicated 3 years to the day, by the way, from the time that Antiochus had defiled it. And... the word dedication in Hebrew, you can look this up if you have a concordance in your Bible. Look for any of the dedication offerings all through the scriptures. Just do a search for the word dedication and look it up in Hebrew. And it's Chanukah. Chanukah means dedication. So this obviously has resulted in the holiday of Hanukkah. Hanukkah came about as on the 25th. 25th of Kislev, which is basically almost always in December, obviously. And I think it is always in December. And because it's late in the November, December, you know, our calendar. So Hanukkah, it's observed every year as a celebration of the rededication of the temple, dedication Chanukah. It's the cleansing and the rededication of the temple after it had been defiled by Antiochus Epiphanes. Now, there's a story you hear quite often about Hanukkah. And, you know, you hear it called the Festival of Lights. And what's the deal with the Festival of Lights? Well, the story goes when the temple was rededicated, they got the menorah, you know, the multi-branch candlestick there, and they went to light it, and somebody looks around and they go, oh, you know, we forgot oil. All we've got is a little bit of oil. So they put the oil in, and they estimate, this is only going to burn for a day, you know, and we need to find some more oil. Well, they can't find any oil anywhere, apparently. And for 8 days, this 1 day's worth of oil burns in this lampstand. 1 day's worth of oil burns for 8 days until they finally have enough oil and then pour it in. Nifty little story. Unfortunately, if you do your history study, you find out that it wasn't until about 600 years later that you ever find this story documented. So it's kind of a bummer, you know, because the whole focus, but it seems like the surface focus of Hanukkah, when somebody says, what's Hanukkah about? Very often they'll get, oh, that's when the temple was rededicated and there was only 1 day's worth of oil and it lasted for eight. That's not the miracle of Hanukkah. The miracle of Hanukkah, I don't believe, has anything to do with oil and the lampstand. I believe the miracle of Hanukkah has everything to do with God doing the same thing that he did in the book of Exodus, in the book of Joshua, and the book of Judges, and the book of Nehemiah. Is this the world and the devil are out to destroy the Jews, and God says, these are my people, and I will not let you mess with them. They will survive. This Maccabean revolt, to me, as I look at this historically, I say, this is the miracle. This is yet another, and again, we'll get, in this history study, we'll get into the more recent victories of the Jews, like the Six-Day War, and these times when, again, against all odds, God says, against all odds, worldly odds, the Jews are going to win. You can see 10,000 fall at your right hand and 100,000 at your left hand, but you're going to stay standing. It's God's way. He preserves a remnant. I think that's the miracle of Hanukkah. Now, if you're a fan of Hanukkah and you like to do the lights and stuff, that's fine. But understand that you can't really verify it until 600 years after the fact. That's just kind of, you know, it's never mentioned in any of the historical. It wasn't mentioned by Josephus, who wrote about this. It wasn't mentioned in Maccabees. It's not till many centuries later. So I don't think that's the miracle of Hanukkah. Now, does that discount what Hanukkah is? I don't think so. As a matter of fact, what I see is that Jesus loves God's people because they're his people in actually more ways than one. You know, he's from the tribe of Judah, from the descendants. He's a root of Jesse and David. They're his people that way, but they're his people because he's God. He's a creator. All things were created by him and for him. So they're his people that way too. And I believe that he delighted in celebrating his faithfulness to his people. What's interesting is that when you read the Gospel of John, you'll see that Jesus was in Jerusalem more than just that final trip to Jerusalem. He, you know, and you remember near the end of his ministry, he kept telling the disciples, we're going to Jerusalem, we're going to Jerusalem, the Son of Man is going to be, you know, a traitor or betrayed, and the Son of Man's going to be betrayed, and he's going to be arrested and tortured and spit upon and crucified and raised from the dead the third day. We're going to Jerusalem. This is all going to happen. That was not the only time he went to Jerusalem. As a matter of fact, in John chapter 10, it shows us that Jesus actually made sure to be in Jerusalem to observe Hanukkah. John 10:22, it says, at that time, the feast of the dedication took place at Jerusalem. It was winter, and Jesus was walking in the temple in the portico of Solomon. Jesus was in Jerusalem, and Jerusalem's out of the way for Jesus' ministry. But he made sure to be in Jerusalem on Hanukkah and to be in the temple. He wasn't like dissing it. No, the glory of God never came and filled the place with smoke and the priests falling down. But I believe Jesus was there to celebrate his faithfulness to the Jews as he had and he would continue to practice that and preserve them to this day and on into the future when the world is breathing out murder and trying to exterminate the Jews in the future in such a way as has never happened before. Antiochus, what happened then? Hitler, what happened then? There's worse coming for the Jews, but God will be faithful. He will absolutely be faithful, and he will mess with the people who mess with his people. I think that's the miracle of Hanukkah, and that's something that we can observe as that holiday comes up. And you know, I'm not a big fan of celebrating things I don't understand, but I sure understand God's faithfulness to his people. So as December rolls around and you're making Christmas preparations, hey, you know, that's awesome. We can focus in on the birth of Jesus Christ. Whether or not that happened in December, probably not. But Hanukkah definitely happened on the 25th of Kislev, which you'll find on your calendar represented accurately there in December. So a good, accurate anniversary to celebrate. Say, God, you are so faithful to your people. Let's tell them that now. God, you are so faithful to your people. We're so thankful to see these things and realizing, Lord, that even though this is intertestament stuff, the Old Testament wrote about it anyway. And to see your hand, your mighty hand in history, Lord, there is no earthly explanation why there's a single Jew alive in the world today. But there is a heavenly explanation, Lord. Your divine providence, your grace, your covenant promises, they've all just come together and showed us that what we call a history is really your story of how you have redeemed fallen man and the people that you have used to bring about the promises and to preserve the scriptures and to demonstrate, Lord, what a perfect example the Jews have made, both in their faithfulness and their unfaithfulness, Lord, in their persecution as well as their prosperity. Lord, you have demonstrated to us time and again your faithfulness to fulfill every one of your promises. Lord, when we look at them and we realize the promises that you've made to us, we're encouraged, not just to pray for the Jews, which we certainly should do, but Lord, to be encouraged saying that you are able to preserve us, that you've called us your children, and though we may suffer persecution and difficulties at times, Lord, that you are so faithful, that you stay with us. The friend that stays closer than a brother. The God who will never leave us nor forsake us. And so, Lord, we are just encouraged to see what you've done in history and know what you're going to do in the future and recognize the same things apply in the present. So, Lord, in encouragement, we just worship you. We give you thanks. We pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.